bounded space of eroticism. Elizabeth and Vito have worked hard to have an equitable marriage, but sex takes them to another place. The power differential that would be unacceptable in her emotional relationship with Vito is precisely what excites Elizabeth erotically. At first, when she discloses her sexual predilection, she is embarrassed. It doesn't fit her image of herself as a liberated, powerful woman. I've struggled to accept what turns me on. For a long time, I was disturbed by my fantasies. Submission just isn't me. It took me years to reconcile what arouses me with my political beliefs. Somewhere in the midst of marriage, kids, and career, I realized that it was time to stop hiding, to stop pretending, and most of all, to stop apologizing for who I was and what I hungered for in the world. Getting older helps. I don't feel as if I have to justify myself. Maybe that's the meaning of sexual liberation. A lot of women find their desire for sexual submission hard to accept. But stepping out of ourselves is exactly what eroticism allows us to do. In Eros, we trample on cultural restrictions. The prohibitions we so vigorously uphold in the light are often the ones we enjoy transgressing in the dark. It's an alternative space where we can safely experience our taboos. The erotic imagination has the force to override reason, convention, and social barriers. The more I point to the tensions in these epiphanies of pleasure, the more relieved Elizabeth seems. I continue. Of course, nothing is scarier than a true loss of control in reality. But the point of fantasy is that it allows you to transcend the moral and psychological constraints of your everyday life. In the liberating expression of sexuality, we give in to our unruly impulses and the disavowed, lurid parts of ourselves. Mordechai Gafni, a scholar of Jewish mysticism, explains that fantasies are like mirrors. We hold them in front of us in order to see what's behind. We spot images of ourselves that are otherwise inaccessible. If commitment requires a trade-off of freedom for security, then eroticism is the gateway back to freedom. In the broad expansiveness of our imagination, we uncover the freedom that allows us to tolerate the confines of reality. The very dynamics of power and control that can be challenging in an emotional relationship can, when eroticized, become highly desirable. In the crucible of the erotic mind, we bring the more vexing components of love, dependency, surrender, jealousy, aggression, even hostility, and transform them into powerful sources of excitement. My patient Oscar can't stand being told what to do by his bossy wife, yet he enjoys being tossed around by her sexually. When she barks orders about the dishes, the experience takes him back to his mom's kitchen. But he does not feel this regressive threat once the lights have been turned off. What he loads in the domestic sphere becomes his choice in the erotic. Maxwell, who keeps a shrewd eye on his beautiful girlfriend's many admirers, repeatedly brings them up when he makes love to her. What threatens in public becomes enchantment in private. He parlays his daily fears into nightly seductions. And Elizabeth, the take-charge woman, loves to get a break when Vito takes over sexually. She does not experience his control as oppressive. On the contrary, she feels taken care of. And she feels a renewed respect for him when, for a change, he knows what to do. His control offers her a safe container in which she can release her lusty self. The imbalance of power is both safe and sexy, at once protective and liberating. Subverting power. Some would say that Elizabeth's desire for submission is nothing more than a reenactment of traditional male domination. They would claim that sexual arrangements in which one partner is dominant and controlling, the other passive and weak, are inherently hierarchical and oppressive, nothing more than a sexist replay of patriarchy. But prisoners rarely have the desire to pretend they are prisoners. Only the free can choose to make believe. To my thinking, being able to play with roles goes some way toward indicating that you're no longer controlled by them. Play has the potential to disrupt the very notion of gender categorization. For Elizabeth, being controlled sexually is itself a subversive act that is ultimately liberating. The same is true for Marcus, who heads the research and development unit of a large international software company. He is a classic type A man, competitive, ambitious, spending more time in the air than on the ground. His tough-mindedness and aggressiveness have made him a natural leader in his highly competitive field. The word power is attached to many of his activities and often turns up in his conversation. He takes power walks, drinks power drinks, does power lunches, and recharges during 10-minute power naps. And in his free time, he likes a good spanking. When Marcus arrives at the house of his girlfriend, it's after a long day of being the boss. With a sexually powerful woman, a dominating woman, he gets a respite from having to be in control. With his girlfriend in charge, in the role of dominatrix, he can give it up, for he knows that she can withstand the intensity of his urges. The surrender not only pleases him erotically, it nurtures him emotionally as well. Like Elizabeth, Marcus gets to experience a submerged but vital facet of himself in the erotic mirror. In our culture, passivity is perceived as female and weak. Consequently, it generates great emotional conflict for a man and for many women. But that doesn't eradicate it from our psyche or make it any less desirable. Marcus fears surrender as much as he craves it. His fantasy permits a bounded passivity, a safe but masked return to the mother's arms. And while he is not interested in intellectual or heavy-duty psychological explanations of his motivation, his erotic inclinations challenge the stereotypical power distribution that always sees the man on top. There is no love without hate. The defenders of modern intimacy, with marital counselors and self-help authors on the front line, have continuously sought to neutralize the thorny issue of power in committed relationships. The ideal partnership is said to be one of absolute equality in every area of the relationship, as if, with scale in hand, we could measure power quantitatively. Many of us, steeped in this ideology of fairness and mutuality, want nothing less. But the fact is that negotiating power is part and parcel of all human relationships. We recognize it most easily when it's expressed outright, through authority, coercion, bullying, aggression, and castigation. The powerful one metes out punishments and rewards depending on one's degree of compliance with his or her wishes. But there's also the power of the weak, deference, passivity, withholding, ingratiation, and the moral one-upmanship of the victim are their own manifestations of might. Power and power imbalances are inescapable. Ethel Persson, in Feeling Strong, writes that we first learn about power differentials in the power grid of our families. All power relationships, all desires to dominate or submit, have their psychological roots in the fact that we were all once little children with big parents, and their existential roots in our feelings of being small people in an out-of-control big world that we need to be able to tame. Childhood is our basic training ground for power tactics. We have our will, our parents have theirs. We demand, they object. We bargain for what we want. They tell us what we can have. We learn to resist and we learn to surrender. At best, we learn to balance, to mediate, to understand. All these permutations of power stumble into our adult intimacies, and gender does matter. Boys and girls undergo a radically different initiation in wielding power. Men become adept at direct expressions of power, women at indirect expressions. and these differences are discernible in our sexual scripts. As adults, we seek control in part as a defense against the vulnerability inherent in love. When we put our hopes on one person, our dependence soars. So do our frustrations and our disappointments. The greater our helplessness, the more dangerous the threat of humiliation. The more we need, the angrier we are when we don't get. Kids know this. Lovers do too. No one can bring us to the boiling point as quickly as our partner, except maybe our parents, the original locus of dependent rage. Love is always accompanied by hate. While we fear the depth of our dependence, many of us are even more frightened by the depth of our rage. We resort to intricate relational contortions in order to keep all this combustion in check. Yet the couples who most successfully implement this model of placidity are rarely passionate lovers. When we confuse assertion with aggression, neutralize otherness, adjust our longings, and reason away our hostility, we assemble a calmness that is reassuring but not very exciting. Stephen Mitchell makes the point that the capacity to contain aggression is a precondition for the capacity to love. We must integrate our aggression rather than eradicate it. He explains, "The degradation of romance, the waning of desire, is due not to the contamination of love by aggression, but to the inability to sustain the necessary tension between them." Jed and Coral. Jed is unassuming. He's a clean-shaven, mild-mannered architect, brilliant and well-spoken. He's kind, never the sort of person to get in your face about anything. But sexually, he's another man. Jed discovered S&M, sadomasochism, as a teenager, and for years he has used eroticism as a venue for aggression. He loves leather, hard surfaces, chains, handcuffs. I used to be shy, and it was hard for me to assert myself. But at the same time, I was angry a lot, and I didn't know where to go with it. I was too afraid of hurting people, so I kept it all inside. "I can see why S&M was so attractive to you," I reply. "You could make demands and not fear hurting anyone." The unambiguous codes, the negotiating beforehand, made it safe for you. Emotionally, you tend to put other people first. Sexual domination is a way for you to override the other person's supremacy. It's a clever answer to your more typical emotional subordination. "Exactly," he says. "But at the same time, you know, it's all about their needs. I'm pleasing them. That's the key piece. They want it. They have to be really into it, or it's a no-go for me." For years, Jed avoided getting serious with women. Becoming close felt obliterating. Haunted by the timid little boy he once was, he dreaded feeling powerless and dependent. "Coral was the first woman I ever loved who I didn't feel indebted to. I wasn't constantly on guard not to be sucked up by the relationship." Jed grew up as a loner, had few friends, and spent much of his adolescence reading science fiction and listening to heavy metal in his room. Coral, who grew up in the same neighborhood, barely remembers him from high school. She was popular, pretty, outgoing. She edited the yearbook. "I wasn't on the A-list, but I had a perfectly respectable place." Even today, Coral has many friends. She's the hub of her social circle, and she has plenty of interests to supplement her rising career as a documentary filmmaker. 11 years after graduating from high school, they ran into each other at a wedding. Jed had learned to mask his shyness with satire, and Coral was drawn to his perceptiveness and offbeat sense of humor. Not to be dismissed was the fact that he had turned into a really handsome guy. She made sure to leave the party with his phone number, for she knew it would be up to her to make the first move. They started dating, and they have been together for 6 years. Jed and Coral are wonderfully compatible in most areas of their life, but sexually, they have very different sensibilities. I don't understand where his motives come from, she says. I've never come across this before, and I've been with plenty of men, and there are plenty of kinky things that excite me. I just don't get this. Maybe because I grew up in a very feminist world of political correctness and respect for women. In a way, I feel disrespected. It feels cheap, tawdry, and it makes me feel like a slut, I ask her. No, I don't think there's anything wrong with being a slut. I was a slut for a long time. It just makes me feel less desirable. I don't feel like it's about me. It doesn't have anything to do with me, and therefore I don't feel connected with it, or motivated, or even interested in it. Does that make sense? Yeah, it makes sense, Jed answers. But for me, I don't see it as forgetting you, forgetting your identity. For me, I see it as I'm honoring you, by being willing to completely step outside my armor of defense and say, well, I trust you enough to show you this. In order for us to move forward, Jed and Coral each need a stronger sense of where the other is coming from. We do an exercise in which they divide a piece of paper by drawing a line down the middle, then separately write their immediate associations of the word love on the left-hand side. I give them prompts. When I think of love, I think of... When I love, I feel... When I am loved, I feel... In love, I look for... As soon as they finish, they write their answers to the next sets of prompts on the right-hand side. When I think of sex, I think... When I desire, I feel... When I am desired, I feel... In sex, I look for... This exercise, though simple, is remarkably illuminating. First, because it lays out exactly how love and desire are parsed in each partner's mind, how separate they are, and how interwoven. Second, it enables me to look at the congruence of these arrangements between partners. As I suspected, Jed and Coral experience sex in opposing ways, and they look to sex for different things. Coral seeks intimate connection through sex, and love charges her desire. She associates love with warmth and security. Being loved makes her feel safe. Being wanted does the same. For her, sex is sanguine, wholesome, luxe. I've connected with every person I've had sex with. Even in one-night stands, I would walk away smiling, thinking I was in love. I had to learn that sex and love aren't always the same thing, that I didn't have to want to marry every man I slept with. For Jed, intimate connection emerges after the fact, and love and sex don't blend nearly as seamlessly as they do for Coral. Love feels safe, but also confining. It is laced with conflict. I feel like I have to restrict what I do and say to avoid hurting her. I feel vulnerable, exposed, and disoriented. It's painful. I think I may not deserve it because I just don't feel worth it. It's still hard to see sometimes what inspires her to love me. I'm anxious. But when it comes to sex, he has an entirely different experience. Sex has always fascinated me. It's the only place I can really be myself, where I can express all kinds of feelings I usually keep under wraps. Sex is deeply entwined with power. They're not fully distinct for me. Aggression is an intrinsic part of his sexuality. It emboldens him. He doesn't need to subordinate himself to the woman's needs or feelings, nor does he get lost in them. I need the power because I felt so powerless for so long in my life. I need to compartmentalize. When the emotional connection is too intense, it hinders the sex, because you start confining yourself. The same confining that you described in the love column, I suggest. If I care about her too much, I can't risk exposing my aggression. I care about what she thinks of me, see? The person can't be too close to me or I feel threatened. I need distance to be turned on. Jed is trying to map out the structure of his sexuality for Coral. Aggression is the initial motivator, but the real sexual charge is the autonomy that aggression permits him. It's about how manners don't matter anymore, what other people think doesn't matter anymore, dignity doesn't matter anymore. All there is need, animal desire. It's freedom, which I've been fighting for my whole life. Let's face it, Jed and Coral aren't an ideal sexual fit, and it's possible that this part of their relationship will never become 9.5 weeks. Yet each time they've considered parting, they've realized that they may find a better sexual match, but not a better life partner. Here's the direction I took. Given Jed's ability to feel mastery largely in sexual dominance, I endorsed Coral's request that she experience some of Jed's assertiveness beyond the bedroom. Part of what makes this so weird for me is that Jed is incredibly passive in every other aspect of our life. The contrast is totally jarring. I wish he were more decisive and less deferential generally. I encouraged Jed to start making some claims outside the sexual arena. He's a novice at this kind of assertiveness. Choosing a restaurant or a movie is hard for him. Telling her he wants to stay in New York for Thanksgiving and not see her entire extended family as they do every year is almost impossible. I never suggest to Jed that he needs to reconfigure his sexuality. But I do urge him to learn to wield power in other areas of his life as well. It's important for Jed to know that his wants will be honored outside the rituals of S&M. By the same token, he wouldn't mind it if Coral transferred some of her directorial boldness from the editing room to their four-poster bed. Jed makes the point that Coral too could bring some assertiveness to their sex life. When you finish brushing your teeth and putting on your pajamas, and then you ask me if we're going to have sex tonight, in this matter-of-fact, nudging way, it just doesn't do anything for me. I need more of a charge. Tell me you want me. Unzip my pants. Walk naked into the room. Something. Anything besides, are we going to have sex tonight? I do it for you. I light the candles. I create the mood you like. Make love to you slowly. I do the vanilla for you. I try. You don't. For Coral's part, she may never like Jed's sexual kinks, but I encourage her to be open to understanding them. By holding court, judging him, and failing to grasp his red light tastes, she's condemned to feeling demeaned. Sadly, she fails to see that Jed is actually taking a big risk by trusting her to enter the primal bug of his erotic self. Rebalancing the dominant culture. Most fans of kinky sex, at least those I've encountered, are drawn by the erotics of power and not, as it may appear to an outsider, by violence or pain. In fact, the carefully negotiated contracts which specify what can and cannot be done, by whom, to whom, and for how long, are meant to guarantee both pleasure and safety. You submit only as much as you're willing, you dominate only as far as you're allowed. In the parallel universe of sex, power bids become a plaything, an experiment, a way to temporarily experience relations we're loath to inhabit in real life. If in our daily life we shun dependence, in our erotic life we might welcome it. If it's our aggression that makes us twitch with discomfort, sexual enactments can permit a safe experience of power. Whether our real-life aversion is to submission, as it is for Elizabeth, or to autonomy, as it is for Jed, the sexual drama can offer catharsis. For years, S&M and DNS, domination and submission, were fringe behaviors that roamed on the outskirts of conventional sexuality. They were primarily a practice of gay men who tended to be more successful than heterosexuals at isolating sexual aggression for the purpose of pleasure, as the sociologist Anthony Giddens notes. In recent years, these marginal practices have moved into the mainstream. A growing number of citizens in the early 21st century, gay and straight, male and female, left and right, urban and suburban, get their sexual kicks from giving and taking orders. There are far too many of them to fit a minority psychological profile. The social critic Camille Paglia sees the rise in domination and submission as a collective fantasy that tweaks the rough spots of our egalitarian culture. It seems to me that rituals of domination and submission are a subversive way to put one over on a society that glorifies control, belittles dependency, and demands equality. In cultures where these values are at a premium, America, for example, we find more and more people seeking to give up control, revel in dependency, and recognize the very inequities no one wants to talk about. Seen in this light, sex clubs are havens of acceptance for what society rejects. This explicit exchange of power, which transfers freely and consensually from one party to another, is a far cry from the rigid distribution of power that pervades our society. In real life, power is much harder to negotiate and almost impossible either to acquire or to relinquish. No one wants to give up her piece of the pie. I am keenly aware of the disparities of power that pervade our society, and not a day goes by when I am not witness to the real fallout of intimate violence. But I also know that aggression, as a human emotion, cannot be purged from human interactions, especially not among those who love each other. Aggression is the shadow side of love. It is also an intrinsic component of sexuality, and it can never be entirely excised from sexual relationships. In my work with couples, I aim to uncover dynamics of power. I try to make them manifest, to examine the tensions, and to redress the inequities. I also look at the harmonious imbalances unique to each couple. Not all inequities are a source of trouble. Sometimes these form a couple's basis of harmony. I don't seek just to neutralize power. I also seek to harness it. Together, we look for ways to express it safely, creatively, fearlessly, and sexually. 5. Can do. The Protestant work ethic takes on the degradation of desire. Energy and persistence conquer all things. Benjamin Franklin. In matters of love, as in much else, America is a goal-oriented society. We prefer explicit meanings, candor, and plain speech to imponderables, ambiguity, and illusion. We rely on the concreteness of words to convey our feelings and needs, rather than on more subtle avenues to closeness. Get to the point. Spit it out. Don't beat around the bush. America invented assertiveness training. This penchant for clarity and unvarnished directness is encouraged by many therapists as well. If you want to make love to your partner, why don't you say it clearly and tell him or her exactly what you want? We believe that with a well-defined goal, a good plan, solid organizational skills, and hard work, anything is possible. This is the idea behind Americans' optimism. With the right effort and unbending determination, there is no obstacle you can't overcome. Hard work is rewarded by success. Conversely, if you fail, you probably are lazy, unmotivated, self-indulgent, and unwilling to really try to get what you want. You lack spunk, and you have only yourself to blame. And there's no reason why this boosterish, essentially entrepreneurial interpretation wouldn't extend to any existential or romantic quandary as well. Apply this business model to romance, and you get books like Find a Husband After 35 Using What I Learned at Harvard Business School by Rachel Greenwald. 5 Minutes to Orgasm Every Time You Make Love by Claire D. Hutchins. And 7 Weeks to Better Sex by Domina Renshaw. Americans cherish the capacity to define what we desire and then score. If you know what you want in your relationship, just go for it. Nailing it down to an exact number of steps, not exceeding 10, promises you entrance into the garden of earthly delights with hardly a minute wasted. As a European, I have always admired Americans' optimism. It's the opposite of the fatalism and resignation that pervade so many other more traditional cultures, and it expresses a healthy sense of entitlement. People here don't like to say that's just the way it is, you can't change it. But this can-do attitude encourages us to assume that dwindling desire is an operational problem that can be fixed. From magazine articles to self-help books, we are encouraged to view a lack of sex in our relationships as a scheduling issue that demands better prioritizing and time management, or as a consequence of poor communication. If the problem is testosterone deficiency, we can get a prescription, an excellent technical solution. For the sexual malaise that can't be so easily medicalized, remedies abound. Books, videos, and sexual accoutrements are there to assist you not only with the basics, but to bring you to unimagined levels of ecstasy. In her book, Against Love, Laura Kipnis writes, "Whole new sectors of the economy have been spawned, an array of ancillary industries and markets fostered, and massive social investments in new technologies undertaken, from Viagra to couples porn, late capitalism's Lourdes for dying marriages, like dedicated doctors keeping corpses breathing with shiny heart-lung machines and artificial organs, couples too, armed with their newfangled technologies, can now beat back passion's death. This pragmatic approach typifies how the great country of manifest destiny goes about solving problems. You break the problem down to its component parts, study each one, and come up with a step-by-step plan that you can work on, a solution that promises calculable results. Apply this to sexual problems, though, and you get a model that focuses more on sexual functioning than on sexual feeling." The sex therapist Lenore Tiefer cautions us that in this paradigm, the body is divvied into a collection of unrelated parts, and satisfaction is seen as a result of their perfect functioning. This emphasis on physical achievement rather than desire and pleasure goes hand in hand with an emphasis on genitals and reinforces the dominant male orientation. The penis is the new patient, having replaced its human owner, and the ability to achieve and maintain a steely erection overshadows any other kind of sexual proficiency. With Viagra, sex is too easily reduced to erections, and the search is on for a female Viagra. Good news for all the helpful husbands currently trading housework for sex, but bad news for the wives who see their own lack of desire as having more to do with romance than with tumescence. The subjective experience of sexual pleasure is replaced by an objective list of criteria that is easily indexed but woefully truncated: erection, intercourse, orgasm. Sexuality is besieged by quantification that provides statistics against which we can compare our own relationships to see if we measure up. Newsweek magazine tells us that the experts currently define a sexless marriage as one in which couples have sex no more than 10 times a year. Those who have sex 11 times in a 12-month period can breathe a sigh of relief. The rest must count themselves among the 15% to 20% of normative sexless couples. We've become exceedingly preoccupied with frequency of sexual activity and number of orgasms. How much sex? How intense is the sex? What's the level of performance? The more diffuse and uncrunchable aspects of sexual expression, love, intimacy, power, surrender, sensuality, and excitement rarely make it to the front page of a newspaper or the cover of a magazine. Eroticism, as an immeasurable quality of aliveness and imagination, is reduced to what the French author Jean-Claude Guibaud calls une arithmétique physiologique, a physiological arithmetic. But when we reduce sex to a function, we also invoke the idea of dysfunction. We are no longer talking about the art of sex. Rather, we are talking about the mechanics of sex. Science has replaced religion as the authority, and science is a more formidable arbiter. Medicine knows how to scare even those who scoff at religion. Compared with a diagnosis, what's a mere sin? We used to moralize, today we normalize, and performance anxiety is the secular version of our old religious guilt. In my experience, a treatment that places a premium on performance and reliability often exacerbates the very problems it purports to solve. The sexual performance perfection industry generates its own inhibitions and anxieties. More often than not, the beauty and flow of a sexual encounter unfurl in a safe, non-competitive, and non-result-oriented atmosphere. Sensuality simply doesn't lend itself to the rigors of scorekeeping. This is not to say that practical advice and expert solutions are never useful or necessary. If you have poor communication, of course you should work at it. If you're too busy for sex, you're too busy. If you lack knowledge, inform yourself. If you have a problematic physical condition, age, hormonal changes, diabetes, prostate cancer, hysterectomy, find a doctor who can offer medical support. There are many books that offer sound help in this area. But while the problem-solving model addresses important aspects of our sexual contretemps, it fails to take on the quixotic and fundamentally existential issues of human eroticism that are far beyond any neat technical fix. When work doesn't work. We are indeed a nation that prides itself on efficiency. But here's the catch. Eroticism is inefficient. It loves to squander time and resources. As Adam Phillips wryly notes, in our erotic life, work does not work. Trying is always trying too hard. Eroticism is an imaginative act and you can't measure it. We glorify efficiency and fail to recognize that the erotic space is a radiant interlude in which we luxuriate, indifferent to demands of productivity. Pleasure is the only goal. Octavio Paz writes, "The moment of merging is a crack in time, a balm against the wounds inflicted by the minutes and hours of time. A moment totally eternal as it is ephemeral. It is a leap into a world beyond." This leap entails a loss of control that we thought from a very young age to guard against. We are socialized to tame our primal side, our unruly impulses, our sexual urges, and our rapacious appetites. Social order is built on this restraint, and lack thereof threatens to create chaos. Because loss of control is almost exclusively seen in a negative light, we don't even entertain the idea that surrender can be emotionally or spiritually enlightening. But experiencing a temporary suspension of our discernible self is often liberating and expansive. I have seen many people stumble when they can't simply take the problem of Eros and fix it. They are left feeling bewildered and frightened by their slackened command. I help them learn how to relinquish control intentionally, as a means of personal growth and self-discovery. Ryan and Christine have been in therapy for a year. I meet with them together and individually as they struggle through the transition from being a sexually entwined couple to being the parents of three small children. Following the birth of their twin daughters, these lovers' erotic inspiration began gasping for air. While some couples accept fading intensity with gracious resignation, settling into affectionate companionship, Ryan and Christine don't want to give up. The memory of what they once had is still dear to them. They make a clear distinction between sex and making love, and they haven't made love in a while. They've rented videos, they've taken baths together, and they are committed to their weekly date. They've tried a lot of things, some yielding satisfying results, others a total waste. Merely having sex is not really their issue. Of course they'd like to have it more often, but their concern is more about intensity than frequency. It's not the diminishing amount of sex that bothers them, but its increasing dullness. They like to be proactive, and they're shopping for new tools. I can think of a number of things that I could suggest to this couple, endorsing their practical approach to the problem of diminishing desire. But I question the rationalist approach in matters of the heart. I think that the challenge of sustaining Eros in a committed relationship over time is of a different nature. We don't always know our aims in advance. Our desires are not exempt from conflict, nor are our passions free of contradictions. No amount of will or reason can dictate our love dreams. Reason doesn't know the roots of our dreams, nor does it know the mysterious needs of the heart. We can't always use the laws of profit and loss in our romantic and erotic lives. Applying the work ethos is tricky. Even the most logical approach cannot neutralize the ambivalence of love. I tell Ryan and Christine, I have nothing new to offer you in the how-to department. You've had dates, you've been burning incense, you've cracked into the astroglide, and it's landed you a steady diet of sex that is satisfactory without being really satisfying. Do I get it? Yes, you get it. But what are you saying? That's it? Like the song? Is that all there is? Christine asks. There's no logic to this. Passion is unpredictable. It doesn't follow the dictates of cause and effect. What works on Monday might not work on Thursday. The solution is often a surprise and not the result of the kind of work you've been doing until now. So let's not talk about work. Instead, let's talk about freedom. Play. Huh? Yeah, try something with me, I suggest to them. It may seem off the beaten path, but since your path has become a dead end, you may as well give it a shot. What rigidifies desire is confinement. I'd like you to think about its opposite, freedom. Talk about it in the broad sense. When do you feel most free in your relationship? In what ways does being married make you more free, and in what ways does it make you less free? How much freedom are you comfortable giving each other, giving yourselves? I start the conversation in my office in the hope that they'll continue it on their own. I like to make suggestions that might jolt people out of their complacency or at least bring about a different way of thinking. I try to create some discomfort with the status quo. Although Ryan and Christine are unhappy with their situation, I'm not sure if they're unhappy enough to brave change. In therapy, I throw out a lot of ideas, never knowing where they'll land or if they'll take root. I let the idea of freedom sit for a while to see if it will sprout. A few months later, Ryan begins one session by announcing, "All right, you want to hear a real midlife story? You're going to get one." My wife's best friend from college came to visit us recently. You know I work from home, so we've had lunch together a few times with the babysitter and the kids. Definitely not a pickup scene. Barbara is a humanitarian worker in her mid-40s who runs programs in crisis situations all over the world. No kids, a serial monogamist, independent, she's committed to the cause, but getting a little tired of the lifestyle. He goes on. She's beautiful too, did I mention that? She lives the life I didn't live. I feel middle-aged and middle-class around her. Nothing wrong with that, you'll say, but her adrenaline is contagious. She really hits a nerve in me, and she excites me. I've developed this amazing crush on her. You know how I've been talking about this feeling of deadness, my energy dropping, my body getting heavier? It's like when I settle down, I shut down. Well, her energy has woken me up. I want to kiss her. I'm scared to do it and scared not to. I feel like a fool, guilty, but I can't stop thinking about her. You know, I meant it when I made my vows. I'm in love with my wife. This has nothing to do with her. It's about something I've lost that I'm afraid I'll never get back. When Ryan married Christine, he slammed the door on cruising. He left his struggling acting career, turned his paralegal moonlighting into a full-time job, and applied for law school. Now he works for environmental organizations as a legal consultant. As I listen to him sounding bewildered by his crush, I see an awakening of his dormant senses. I don't discourage Ryan's immature wishes, and I don't lecture him. Nor do I try to talk reason into him or explore the emotional dynamics beneath this presumably adolescent crush. I simply value his experience. He is looking at something beautiful. Fantasizing about Barbara is a way of living the life he hasn't chosen. I marvel with him at the allure of the enchantment, while also calling it by its true name, a fantasy. The question I pose to him is how he can relish this experience without allowing the momentary exhilaration to endanger his marriage. How beautiful and how pathetic, I say. It's great to know you can still come to life like that, and you know that you can never compare this state of intoxication with life at home, because home is about something else. Home is safe. Here, you're trembling. You're on shaky ground. You like it, but you're also afraid that it can take you too far away. I think that you probably don't let your wife evoke such tremors in you. There's an evolutionary anthropologist named Helen Fisher who explains that lust is metabolically expensive. It's hard to sustain after the evolutionary payoff, the kids. You become so focused on the incessant demands of daily life that you short-circuit any electric charge between you. At our next session, Ryan knows exactly where he wants to start. Earlier that week, Christine and Barbara had made plans to go out to dinner. Feeling guilty, as she usually does, about going out without him, Christine invited Ryan to come along. Then she proceeded to ignore him for the rest of the evening. For once, he didn't mind taking a back seat as he watched the women reminisce. After college, they had both spent a year in Togo with the Peace Corps. Christine came home. Barbara never did. As was often the case in their conversations, each reported her envy of and admiration for the life of the other. "We'd just finished a great bottle of Australian Shiraz," said Ryan, "and we were all pretty tipsy when Christine totally shocked me by blurting out to Barbara, 'I look at you and I wonder if it's all worth it. Frankly, I don't think I'm made for this. The kids, the house, the job. Sometimes I wonder if I did it just to prove I could.' Then," she says, "I find it all so oppressive." She wondered if it all was worth it? She finds it oppressive? I was stunned. Ryan repeated these words in a dazed voice as if he still couldn't quite believe hearing them. At my prodding, he told me the rest of his wife's remarks, that she felt she had always just done what was expected of her, that this was easier than figuring things out on her own. He continued, his tone both mocking and full of admiration, as he expertly mimicked his wife. "I know it's not right to complain when you have it all," she says. "Where's my gratitude? I'm blessed with the kids, with Ryan, the remnants of a decent career, good friends. When you don't have it, the family, the marriage, you romanticize it. At least I did. But then, when you do have it, you feel trapped. I have my blissful moments, but mostly I'm mired in drudgery." Ryan said nothing at the time, but he felt stunned. How was I supposed to know she felt that way? She always looked happy enough to me. I thought she had what she wanted. I thought I was the only one feeling restless. Now he was divided. On one hand, he was angry that she hadn't lived up to his expectations. On the other, he was anxious about what her polemic said about him. In my mind, she's a rock. I'm the squirmy one. I've had to work hard at being who I thought she wanted me to be, creating this life together. I felt put down. If she feels trapped, mired in drudgery, what does that make me? "Do you need her to acknowledge your hard work?" I asked. "I guess so. Somehow, her doubts diminished the value of my efforts. But then, this weird thing happened." He paused before speaking again. "I started to like it." "Explain," I said. "It's like I did a complete 180. I couldn't interrupt her, which I probably would have done if we'd been alone. Not that she would ever say this stuff to me anyway. Besides, I was intrigued. She felt just like I did. She was saying the very same things I didn't dare say. She wanted more. She was hungry too. She missed her freedom. She kept becoming more interesting to me, more foreign. The wine really loosened her tongue." "What else did she say?" I too was curious. The actor in him couldn't resist playing her part. "I feel like we're just stuck together," he said, again imitating her voice. "Sometimes I fantasize about other lives, other men. Not any one man in particular. I just imagine a clean slate, unencumbered, no history, no problems. Someone I could be different with. I get so resentful that I'm stuck in this house, in this family, inside my body. All I want to say is leave me alone, don't bother me." Ryan shared with me the unexpected denouement of the evening. I started out shocked, and then defensive, and then angry. But weirdly, the more she was going on, the more I wanted her. She was on fire. At first I thought, oh, just quit the diatribe. But then I was captivated by her. I identified with her, and in a strange way I felt closer to her and more turned on than I had in a long time. My fascination with Barbara vanished, And I knew that if I'd married Barbara, I'd be longing for Christine. And you didn't have to work for it, I say. I couldn't have sent you home with an assignment that would have had this kind of result. I explained to him that his renewed desire came from her reassertion of her separateness and her dreams. When she voiced her unrequited longings, she gave Ryan permission to unleash his. It's all highly impractical sometimes. The same scenario with a different couple might have triggered a fear of abandonment that would have caused the fight of the century. Nobody can plan for this. That's the point. Desire is an enigma. It's insubordinate, and it chafes at impositions. That evening, Ryan was receptive to Christine. In her honesty, he discovered her again. Even more important, he was choosing her again, and it's the act of choosing, the freedom involved in choosing, that keeps a relationship alive. The flambé that Ryan and Christine savored that night had nothing efficient or expedient to it. It wasn't a task they could incorporate into their weekly routine. Christine rattled the cage, and Ryan was dislodged. She claimed her individuality, and the end result was greater intimacy. Desire emerged from a paradox. Mutually recognizing the limitation of married life created a bond between them. Acknowledging otherness inspired closeness. There is no way to institutionalize or create a personal marital policy for this couple that will somehow ensure that they will go on having or ever again have this experience. As a therapist, I acknowledge that setting up some kind of programmatic reinforcement to help them maintain this newfound glow is beyond my ability. But even though I can't turn this into an assignment or exercise, the fact that it happened may wake them up to a different kind of reality. It's my hope that it will change the way they look at themselves and at each other. A paradox to manage, not a problem to solve. What makes sustaining desire over time so difficult is that it requires reconciling two opposing forces, freedom and commitment. So it's not only a psychological or practical problem. It's also a systemic one that makes it harder to work at. It belongs to the category of existential dilemmas that are as unsolvable as they are unavoidable. Ironically, even the business world, which is all about pragmatism and effectiveness, recognizes that some problems do not have clear solutions. We find the same polarities in every system: stability and change, passion and reason, personal interest and collective well-being, action and reflection, to name but a few. These tensions exist in individuals, in couples, and in large organizations. They express dynamics that are part of the very nature of reality. Barry Johnson, an expert on leadership who is the author of Polarity Management, Identifying and Managing Unsolvable Problems, describes polarities as a set of interdependent opposites that belong to the same whole. You can't choose one over the other. The system needs both to survive. Ben, for example, has a new girlfriend every 6 months, and each time he's convinced he's found the one. But when the erotic intensity wanes even slightly, he panics and bails, thinking it's all downhill from here. I guess it wasn't love after all. He talks a lot about wanting a stable relationship. He wants commitment. He's ready to pair up. But his tolerance for sexual ennui is nil. In Ben's experience, commitment and excitement are mutually exclusive. But in his fantasy, there is an omnipotent woman out there who can make it all come together. Her enchanting powers will ensure that the sex remains vibrant, the clearest sign of enduring love. She will be a woman who is so extraordinary, so amazing, that her sheer perfection will induce him to want to settle down. As if all this has nothing to do with him. Invariably, her unavailability is her single most attractive feature. He's been saying the same thing for years. I just haven't found the right person yet. I've met loads of women, I just haven't met the right one, the one I could really stay with. I ask my friends who they would set me up with, and they can't think of anyone either. So, you see? Ben is in perpetual search for the ideal woman. Of course, he's been looking for a long time. Even the most idealized creature ultimately turns out to be merely human, and therefore flawed. At the beginning of each encounter, he is swept away and free from his inner turmoil. Invariably, when the initial ascent levels off, his phantoms reappear, as even the most beautiful princess will not deliver him from himself or from the challenges of love. No matter how extraordinary she is, she can't protect him from the tedium that comes with time and its disillusionments. After each failed relationship, he falls into what Octavio Paz calls a swamp of concupiscence, and we more commonly refer to as a sex binge. These multiple encounters offer him Olympian pleasures at night, but only C-level dialogue the next morning. So each encounter quickly starts to feel empty, and he again finds himself yearning for the fantasy of connection with a stable partner. Hungry, after months of casual sex, he approaches his new conquest with no less panic. Every time Ben falls in love, he goes from 0 to 100 in one swoop. He can't pace himself. He can't get enough. He incorporates her, and not just sexually. It's the opposite swing of the pendulum, totally symmetrical and just as intense. People like Ben are easily disparaged for their extreme reactions, but they're also a compelling topic of conversation. Ben is the one people like to gossip about with a mixture of pity, mainly the women, and envy, mainly the men. He's a live version of the conflict that so many of us experience silently or in a more subdued fashion. Knowing Ben's romantic nature, I'm reluctant to prescribe concrete sexual interventions designed to recharge his libido. Ben is advice resistant. Pragmatic solutions don't work for him, because his quandary is less something to repair than something to acknowledge. With this in mind, I borrow an exercise from Barry Johnson. I tell Ben, I want you to breathe in and keep the air in as long as you can. Fresh oxygen inevitably turns into suffocating carbon dioxide, forcing him to exhale. At first, the release feels wonderful, but a few moments later, he craves fresh oxygen again. I explain, you can't choose between inhaling and exhaling. You have to do both. It's the same thing with intimacy and passion. I explain to Ben that the tension between security and adventure is a paradox to manage, not a problem to solve. It is a puzzle. Can you hold the awareness of each polarity? You need each at different times, but you can't have both at the same time. Can you accept that? It's not an either-or situation, but one where you get the benefits of each and also recognize the limits of each. It's an ebb and flow. Love and desire are two rhythmic yet clashing forces that are always in a state of flux and always looking for the balance point. Ben has been going out with Adair for the past 8 months, a record for him, and something different is happening. I think I'm in love with this woman, he says. Okay, I think I'm in love with every woman, but this one is different. Okay, everyone is different, but this one is really different. She grounds me. I can be freaking out about something, you know how I get, and she doesn't react. Not that she doesn't care or doesn't respond, but she doesn't get in there and panic right along with me. There's something quiet about her, and, you know, I'm anything but quiet. I think this could work. I like being with her, and the sex is still pretty good. I'm waiting for the but, I tell him. But I do feel it changing. I'm getting nervous, restless. I really don't want to fuck this up. I'm 43 years old, for God's sake. I want to have a kid, but I'm afraid I won't be able to stick around. I have never met Adair, but something about the way she handles Ben makes me feel optimistic. Unbeknownst to him, he has a foil for his, dare I say, fear of intimacy. In the past, his girlfriends have only been too happy to merge with him. But Adair is able to hold her own. She seems to have a real sense of self that exists independently of him. Even after 8 months, she is fiercely discreet about her private life. She exudes a quiet equanimity, a sober and subtle intelligence. She is a nurse in a pediatric oncology unit and works in the looming presence of death. Ben makes her laugh. He brings lightness into her world. His thirst for life enlivens her. His erotic ardor is the opposite of morbid. She likes the contrast. Ben certainly brings an entire emotional history to his predicament, and he's got a lot of stuff to deal with. But the difficulty of reconciling security and excitement is not purely the result of his personal problems. It is the challenge of the modern ideal of love. With this in mind, we examine what sexuality means for Ben. Most of us lament the wilting of erotic passion with melancholy, quiet acquiescence, or severe agita. But maintaining erotic vitality does not become the organizing principle of our lives. Not so for Ben. Sex is where he finds himself most alive. It has a regenerative power that allows him to go back into the world feeling enriched and renewed. In lovemaking, he feels connection and nurturance that he doesn't get anywhere else. He's at once vulnerable and masterful, exposed and confident. Ben is a man with an active brain. Subjected to high-octane libidinal impulses, he's driven mostly in high gear. He gets frantic and disorganized, yet his hyperactivity has served him well in running his own courier company. For Ben, sex is the ultimate regulatory experience that quells his manic energy. Extreme tension is followed by total release. At no time does he feel as calm as when he has reached the hedonistic apex. It's a moment of perfect harmony between him and the world. And while Adair likes sex, Ben needs it. Sex is his life support. Unplug it, and he thinks he's dying. No wonder he panics at the thought of sex going downhill. Ben is a modern man par excellence. He's action-driven, and that is why his typical response to sexual restlessness is to end the relationship, start going out again, have hot sex with someone else, and start a new relationship that will, he hopes, be inoculated against erotic demise. I point out to Ben that contrary to popular belief, taking action is not always the best course. The first thing is not to act instantly on your panic and shut Adair out as a way to get rid of your anxiety, I tell him. Less sex doesn't necessarily mean less love. I offer a safe container for his stirred-up anxiety, and I encourage him to think through the contradictions of desire rather than act on them. This pushes Ben out of his old way of thinking. I ask him to acknowledge his dilemma and to observe it with compassion and lucidity. Working through a conflict is not the same as eliminating it. In the recognition and management of the duality lies the survival of desire. For Ben, acting out sexually is a short-lived solution. It provides a temporary solve to his anxiety, allowing him to duck the harder questions. What would it take for him to feel excited and safe in the same relationship? Why are exhilaration and playfulness cordoned off from love and commitment in his mind? How can he preserve a sense of freedom in the midst of an intimate relationship? I reinterpret Ben's anxiety by suggesting that it can serve him as an early warning system against complacency. In the past, you reacted to your anxiety by bolting. I want you to think of it as a tool instead. Your anxiety is your ally, a barometer of your need to take some risks. When you start to feel antsy, it's time for something, not someone new. I give him the following quotation from Frank Jude Boxio, author of Mindfulness Yoga, to think about as he leaves the session. We bitch about our difficulties along the rough surface of our path. We curse every sharp stone underneath until, at some point in our maturation, we finally look down to see that they are diamonds. We live in times where faster is better and control is power, where performance trumps process and risk is mathematically calculated. In our overcommitted lives, there's a temptation to simplify our existential complexities. We just don't have the time and patience for open-ended reflection. We prefer instead to be proactive and thereby reaffirm our sense of control. In my practice, I meet couples who complain about how the routine of their life has left them feeling numb. But when we continuously invest in the kind of pragmatic solutions for doing sex that promise regularity, a decent average, we run the risk of exacerbating the blandness we struggle to remedy. Eroticism challenges us to seek a different kind of resolution, to surrender to the unknown and ungraspable, and to breach the confines of the rational world. Six, sex is dirty. Save it for someone you love. When Puritanism and Hedonism collide. Sex without sin is like an egg without salt, wrote Louise Buñuel. I regret to say that we of the FBI are powerless to act in cases of oral genital intimacy, unless it has in some way obstructed interstate commerce. Statement by J. Edgar Hoover. Why do so many couples become erotically alienated? The list of factors that contribute to the waning of excitement is long, and the one most commonly invoked is stress. As soon as I sit down, I see the laundry that still needs folding, the unopened mail, the strewn toys, and it takes all sexual desire away from me. Between our new jobs, our old parents, and our young kids, I'm wiped out. I don't have a very strong sex drive to begin with, but right now I don't have any desire for it at all. Don't take it personally. But when my patients cite the all-too-real stresses of modern life to explain why romance went south, I suggest that there may be more to it. After all, stress was a reliable feature of their lives long before they met, and it didn't stop them from leaping into one another's arms. In the next tier of justifications, they trot out the deeper problems in the relationship, the heated bickering and icy standoffs, the lack of trust, the chronic disappointments, the cycle of blame. Sex? You must be kidding. After what you just said to me? When's the last time you showed me you were interested? Do you think you could put just a little effort into making yourself attractive? I wish you'd shut the damn TV off. It makes me feel like dead meat. This litany of disenchantment notwithstanding, I believe there's an additional layer to our libidinal demise that has to do with our culture's deep ambivalence around sexuality. While we recognize the importance of sex, we nonetheless vacillate between extremes of excessive license and repressive tactics. Don't do it till you're married. Just do it when you feel like it. It's no big deal. It's a huge deal. You need love. What's love got to do with it? It's an all-or-nothing approach to sex. Porn sites proliferate on the internet, yet we continue to debate whether or not to provide sex education in our schools, and if so, whether we should call it sex ed or opt for the less graphic health ed. Despite living in a time of unprecedented sexual freedom in America, the practice of policing sexuality has continued unabated since the days of the Puritans. State intervention makes some of us breathe a sigh of relief while leaving others stricken with terror. We promote abstinence with fear-based tactics, threaten straying politicians with impeachment, fight gay marriage, and gnaw away at the fragile abortion laws. Though virginity seems a relic of a bygone era, every day our elected officials bring a moral gravitas to the legislation of sexuality. Abortion, homosexuality, adultery, and family values have been active items on the national political agenda for more than 30 years. This sexual conservatism is rooted in the Puritan tradition, with its deep suspicion of pleasure and its moralistic attitude toward anything that strays from heterosexual, monogamous, marital, reproductive sexuality. Meanwhile, television producers invite us to phone in if we've had more than 100 sexual partners. Never before has sex been so publicly displayed, an incessant barrage of explicit images wherever we rest our eyes. Sex, the perennial default for advertising, has also become a commodity in itself. Tune in to almost any daytime talk show to hear about mothers who sleep with their daughters' boyfriends, men who like to watch, and housewife prostitutes who come out to their unsuspecting husbands. Sex is everywhere, in all its permutations, as exhaustively described by Lillian Rubin. Pornography, impotence, premarital sex, marital sex, extramarital sex, group sex, swinging, S&M, and as many of the other variations of sexual behavior their producer can think of, whether the ordinary or the bizarre. The politics and economics of sex and the diametrically opposed attitudes we witness daily penetrate the American bedroom and insinuate themselves into the creases of our intimacy. The couples I see live at the intersection of this ambivalence and must negotiate amid these competing value systems. The legacy of Puritanism, which locates the family at the center of society, expects marriage to be reasonable, sober, and productive. You work, you save, and you plan. You take your commitment seriously. But alongside this very American notion of individual responsibility and moderation is the equally apple pie notion of individual freedom. We believe in personal fulfillment, in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We relish the freedom to spontaneously satisfy our desires, and we live in a market-driven consumer economy which ensures that those desires never stop coming. The sexual culture tells us what is attractive and what we should want, as if we were incapable of finding out for ourselves whom we desire and what turns us on. An entire industry of hedonism hovers on the outskirts of marriage, a constant reminder of all we've sacrificed in exchange for the muted sexuality of marital love. Can our modern-day relationships ever be strong enough to withstand the siren song of unlimited pleasure? When we are constantly exhorted to replace the old with the new, when sexual images forever portray youth and beauty, since nobody ages but you, when online sex caters to your most idiosyncratic whim, can we reasonably expect to remain contented with the same person for 50 years? The jury is still out. We promised immediate fulfillment, and it's there for the taking by everyone but us. And all this reinforces the profound disconnect between what we're encouraged to want and what we're allowed to have. Puritanism and hedonism collide. Sex is dirty. Save it for someone you love. Let's not be fooled into thinking that this saturation reflects enlightened sexual attitudes. The blatant marketing of sexual images may be more excessive than progressive. And it has at its roots profit and the freedom of the market rather than freedom of thought. In short, it's more about opening your wallet than opening your mind. Perhaps this is why our culture's underlying city-on-a-hill morality remains unsoiled by all the graphic images that flicker on our screens. The central idea that sex is dirty remains unchallenged. Nowhere is our profound discomfort with sex more apparent than in the way we approach teenage sexuality. A sizable group of Americans believe that limiting access to birth control and sex education will steer our teenagers away from the temptations of the flesh. Campaigns like Not Me, Not Now encourage abstinence as a means of avoiding teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. And our public health policies reflect the idea that adolescent sexuality is deviant behavior that should be prevented. No matter how liberated the media may appear, to many Americans, sexuality is considered deeply dangerous, a risk factor. Europeans, in contrast, view adolescent sexuality as a normal developmental stage on the way to healthy adult sexuality. Sex is not a problem. Being irresponsible about sex is. Hence, the European counter-slogan to Not Me, Not Now is Safe Sex or No Sex. It's also worth noting that in Europe, teenagers engage in sexual activity an average of 2 years later than their American counterparts, and the rate at which teenagers give birth is a staggering 8 times less. How is it that American society, with such a clear bias against teen sex, produces such a statistical embarrassment? Taboo-ridden sexuality and excess-driven sexuality converge in a troubling way. Both lead us to want to dissociate psychically from the physical act of sex. A society that sees sex as soiled does not make sex go away. Instead, this kind of anxious atmosphere breeds guilt and shame in its more extreme version, or a generalized discomfort in its more ubiquitous expression. sex is divorced from emotional and social continuity. What is missing is a sexuality that is integrated, in which pleasure flourishes in a context of relatedness. I'm not talking only about deep love. I'm also talking about basic care and appreciation for another person.